by Senator Bonoff for right now. The meeting, June 30th meeting of the Legislative Audit Commission will come to order. We have several items on the agenda for today. The first is the program evaluation for charter schools. Mr. Nobles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Legislative Audit Commission and members of the audience. My name is Jim Nobles, and I'm the Legislative Auditor. Minnesota is known as a leader in offering educational choices to students and their families. And charter schools are an important part of the educational choices that are offered to those students and families in Minnesota. Because they are so important, the Legislative Audit Commission requested that the Office of the Legislative Auditor evaluate Minnesota's charter schools. Much of the focus of the OLA report is on structure, accountability, and oversight. On the roles and responsibilities of the Minnesota Department of Education, charter school sponsors, and charter school boards. And as is often the case with an OLA evaluation, we found a mixed picture. Strengths and weaknesses, things that need to be kept, things that need to be changed, and things that need to be discarded. We also found a mixed picture when we examined the academic performance of charter schools. But the bottom line is improvement is needed. We anticipate that some charter school advocates will say that our conclusions on performance are unfair because data are limited, because each charter school is unique, and because some charter schools serve particularly challenged students and families. All of these points are true. Data are limited. We can only offer a snapshot of academic performance. But careful use of even limited data can offer helpful insights. And while snapshots never tell the whole story of a trip, of a family, or of a charter school, we still take them to mark important milestones. And indeed, charter schools are by design not all cut from the same cloth. In doing this evaluation, we were often told, when you've seen one charter school, you've seen one charter school. And in doing this evaluation, we saw with our own eyes, through the data and through visits, that some charter schools serve students and families that do face very difficult daily challenges. So all of these factors, limited data, the uniqueness of charter schools, and the challenges that they face, should be and were taken into consideration in the OLA analysis. But in the end, I think we all need to remember that Minnesota has set a standard of academic performance that all public schools, including charter schools, must meet. To tell you more about what we found and what we recommend, I want to introduce Judy Randall, the manager of OLA's evaluation of charter schools.
Ms. Randall, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Judy Randall, and I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I'm pleased to be here today to talk with you about our evaluation on charter schools. Before I get started, I'd like to thank my colleagues, Christina Connolly and Katie Peel, sitting back here. They helped do much of the research and helped write the report, and also sitting in the audience somewhere are Sarah Roberts and Dan Jacobson, who also helped us with our evaluation. Let me start by just giving a big, brief overview on charter schools. As you know, Minnesota was the first state to authorize charter schools, and it did so in 1991. And really, the big idea behind charter schools was to provide more educational choices for Minnesota students and their families. Charter schools operate outside of the traditional school district structure. So parents, teachers, community members, they come together, they form a charter school, and it's separate from the existing school districts. Now, charter schools are exempt from some of the laws that apply to traditional school districts, and in part, in exchange for this flexibility with the law, they are subject to additional oversight by sponsors. And I'll be talking more about sponsors throughout the presentation, but kind of the quick overview of a sponsor is that it's an additional layer of oversight. It's not an organization or entity that financially supports a charter school. Instead, it's an additional layer of oversight. In the 2006-07 school year, there were about 24,000 charter school students. This was about 3% of Minnesota's K-12 student population. And in the 07-08 school year, this past school year, there were 143 operating charter schools. And these charter schools were really located across the state. And this map here, you can see that in fact, they are located across the state. The majority of charter schools are located in the 7-county metro region, and especially concentrated in Minneapolis and St. Paul. But again, they are across the state. Here you can see the school demographics of charters and district schools, and you can see how they're really quite different. Here at the top in the red are the charter schools, and the yellow are at the bottom. You can see in 2007, over half of charter school students were eligible for free or reduced price lunch, as compared with 30% of district school students. Over half of charter school students, were minority students, as compared with 22% of district school students. Similarly, with limited English proficiency students, 21% of charter school students had limited English proficiency, as compared with 7% of district schools. And you can see on special education students, the percentages are much more similar. And in fact, district schools had slightly more special education students enrolled. That would be 14% as compared with the 12%. So that's the high-level overview of charter schools. Most of our recommendations focus on oversight, accountability, and the structure of charter schools. Before I get into those findings and recommendations, though, I want to talk a bit about charter school performance. For our charter school performance analysis, we used 2007 MCA 2 data, the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment Series 2 data. And there are some limitations, and Mr. Noble's touched on them a bit, and I want to just expand on them a little bit more. So the first thing is we used 1 year of data. And secondly, the MCA 2 data provides a snapshot of performance. You know, by its nature, it's measuring how students perform against the state's standards. It doesn't measure growth or progress that a student may have made. That being said, even with these limitations, we think the data can provide some real useful insights. And again, that snapshot that Mr. Nobles was talking about, that can give us a sense of how charter schools are performing. We found that statewide, charter schools did not perform as well as district schools. One example of this is with respect to adequate yearly progress, or AYP, which is the measure that states use to measure progress against the federal government's No Child Left Behind requirements. In 2007, half of Minnesota charter schools made AYP, and this was compared with two-thirds of district schools making AYP during the same time period. And we wanted to dig a little bit deeper in the data, and especially in light of those student demographics that I showed you on the previous slide. So what we did is we tried to match up each charter school with a group of similar district schools. And we did this in a couple of different ways. First, we divided all the charter schools into four regions in the state: Minneapolis, St. Paul, the 7-county metro region, excluding the inner cities, and then outstate Minnesota. And then within those four regions, we identified for each charter school a group of district schools that had similar percentages of free and reduced lunch and minority student enrollment. So we called these the comparable district schools. So when we compared, just to expand, I guess, make that point a little more clear. So, for example, a Minneapolis charter school would be compared with Minneapolis district schools that had similar percentages of free and reduced lunch and minority student enrollment. So within these regions and these comparable student demographics. When we compared the charter school, oh, I went the wrong way. When we compared charter schools with these similar district schools, we found that charter schools still did not perform as well. For example, 15% of charter schools performed better than these comparable district schools on the math MCA 2, but 51% of charter schools performed worse than these comparable district schools, again, on the math MCA 2. Now, that's kind of the big picture, but there, of course, was variation, and some charter schools did do better than the district schools that they were compared to. And in particular, charter schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul were more likely to outperform those comparable district schools than were charter schools in other parts of the state. Now, we also looked at a couple of other factors that research shows can affect academic performance. So we also looked at the rates of limited English proficiency, special education students, and student mobility. And as you probably know, student mobility is a measure of student turnover during the school year. And we found that the student mobility rate seemed really highly related to academic performance. And this is also borne out in the research. One thing that we found is that many charter schools had extraordinarily high rates of student mobility. And in fact, when we were able to account for region, free and reduced lunch, minority student populations, and the mobility rate, we found that the differences between charter school student performance and district school student performance diminished significantly. Now, charter school students still did not perform as well as district schools, even when compared to these comparable schools, but the differences became quite narrow. So that's a lot of information about student performance that I know I've kind of thrown out at you. Let me kind of just sum it up in two sentences, perhaps. Overall, charter schools and charter school students do not do as well as district schools and district school students. However, there's variation. And when we account for all these differences, the region, the minority rate, the free and reduced lunch rate, and student mobility, the differences became quite small. I'm going to switch now from talking about the student performance to talking about oversight and accountability for charter schools. Again, this is where the bulk of our recommendations came into place. Overall, we found that charter school oversight is unclear and really quite complicated. As I mentioned earlier, every charter school must have a sponsor, which is an organization that must authorize the charter school and then monitors and evaluates the academic and financial performance of the school. In addition to the charter school, the Department of Education also has an oversight role over each charter school. And we put together this kind of simple diagram maybe to show you how complicated actually this structure is. So at the top you see the Department of Education, and you can see it has direct responsibility and oversight responsibility over charter school boards. And just like in school districts, and school districts have a board, charter schools also have charter school boards. Charter school boards are elected by the teachers in the school and by the parents of the students who attend the school. So the Department of Education has direct oversight over the board. And then we have kind of this dashed or broken line, if you will, between the Department of Education and sponsors. And then sponsors also have a direct oversight line over charter school boards. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about this structure and in particular about that relationship between the department and sponsors. Let me first talk a little bit about who the sponsors are, because it's kind of a unique concept to charter schools. In this last school year, in the 07-08 school year, there were 53 sponsors. By law, sponsors have to be certain types of organizations, higher education institutions. So, for example, Hamline University is a sponsor. Independent school districts, so St. Paul is a sponsor. LeSort Henderson School District is a sponsor. Intermediate school districts, which are collaboratives of independent school districts, they're also, a couple of them are sponsors. Nonprofit organizations, such as Volunteers of America, Pillsbury United Communities, certain nonprofit organizations that meet certain asset requirements may also be sponsors. Education districts, which are other collaboratives of districts, are allowed to be sponsors, but none were in the past school year. And then the Department of Education currently sponsors 10 charter schools through a grandfather clause, but they are not permitted to sponsor any new charter schools. And as I mentioned previously, sponsors must approve charter schools. A charter school can't be established unless a sponsor has approved it or authorized it. And then sponsors, and this is the language in law, must monitor and evaluate the fiscal and student performance of the charter schools they sponsor. Again, I want to just reiterate that sponsors don't financially support their charter schools. They have an oversight role. As part of our research, we visited 10 sponsors, so about 20% of the sponsors. We visited 14 charter schools, about 10% of the charter schools, and we surveyed all of them. And based on that information, we found that sponsors really vary in the amount of oversight that they provide. Some of the sponsors that we heard from and visited are really very involved and engaged in overseeing their charter schools. They require monthly financial reports, the board minutes, they attend the board meetings, they visit the school, they get academic testing performance and compare the tests to schools that they've identified as comparable to their charter schools and are really heavily involved in overseeing their charter schools. Some sponsors we visited, however, have a much more hands-off and really quite minimal oversight role. One sponsor we visited meets with his charter school once a year to review a report that the charter school has prepared, and that's the extent of the oversight relationship. Some of the sponsors we visited said they didn't feel equipped to perform all of the duties a sponsor is expected to perform. For example, a couple of sponsors said that they didn't have the financial expertise to review a charter school's budget and financial statements. One sponsor we visited didn't know that her school had not made adequate yearly progress in the previous year. And one sponsor told us that he wasn't really sure what the sponsor's role was. So there's a lot of variation there, a lot of different levels of oversight, and certainly not everybody is not all of the sponsors are providing the level of oversight that I think is expected in the law. And we think some of this variation is due in part to lax oversight of sponsors by the department or by anybody else. And in fact, we found that the department does not oversee charter school sponsors. And I think that this might be different than your handout, but we'll go with it and see. The other thing is that we found that the department, there's gaps in oversight in terms of not necessarily overseeing the sponsors, and then there's some duplication of effort, and I'm going to talk about that too. So first, regarding the gaps, the department does not approve a sponsor's overall ability to sponsor a charter school. So it doesn't look at a sponsor. A sponsor doesn't have to go through its own application process. And the department doesn't vet a sponsor and say, yes, it has the abilities to perform all of the responsibilities. Similarly, the department doesn't, on an ongoing basis, hold sponsors accountable to standards. Now, while the department doesn't approve the sponsor in general and doesn't hold them accountable ongoing, so we saw some gaps here, the department does approve all of the charter school applications. And actually, what we found is that this leads to some duplication of effort. So we've got the gaps in terms of oversight of sponsors, and then we have some duplication in terms of the charter school's application process. Because many of the sponsors we visited actually have very rigorous charter school application processes. Many sponsors require charter schools to go through this application process. Once a sponsor and a charter school agree to form a relationship, then the charter school has to apply to the Department of Education and go through another rigorous application process. So again, we saw some gaps here regarding sponsor oversight, and we saw some duplication regarding the charter school application process. So we had some recommendations in the report regarding this structure. The main one is that we think the legislature needs to clarify the role of sponsors in the Department of Education. In our report, we lay out three different options for the legislature to consider, but we recommend one, which is really requiring the Department of Education to approve sponsors, and then once the sponsors are approved, those approved sponsors would have increased authority. To do this, the department would need to implement standards for sponsors, and we view these as pretty high standards. Sponsors would have to demonstrate that they have a rigorous application process and that they have the ability and capacity and understanding to oversee charter schools' financial and academic performance. In addition to implementing the standards, the department would need to provide relevant sponsor training so the sponsors are equipped to meet the standards. And then also we think the department needs to ensure on an ongoing basis that the sponsors meet these standards. We don't say this directly in the report, but really it's basically an accreditation process for sponsors. And that they would have to renew their accreditation every 5 years. What we see is once sponsors are kind of held accountable to this higher level, then we think they can directly approve the charter schools without the department's involvement. So what we see is the department approving sponsors and sponsors approving charter schools. Now, the department would still have a level of oversight over charter schools, but it would be the same that it has for all public schools. So it would oversee the reporting and the financial compliance, but it wouldn't have this other kind of additional layer of oversight that it has of charter schools now that it doesn't have of other public schools. All right, that's kind of a lot to take in, I know. I'm going to move from talking about the Department of Education and sponsors to talking about charter school boards, which, of course, is another layer in the charter school oversight structure. We found that the conflict of interest provisions for charter school boards are inadequate. Specifically, the conflict of interest laws for charter schools are weaker than the comparable federal requirements, and also the conflict of interest laws for charter schools do not address potential conflicts of interest with sponsors. And this gets a little complicated, and we thought the best way to do this was just to put this table up and kind of walk everybody through it. There's three different laws that apply to charter schools regarding conflict of interest. The Minnesota Charter School Law, the Federal Charter School Law. Now, the Federal Charter School Law only applies when a charter school receives federal funds. This is typically in the first 3 years of operation, and then sometimes ongoing if they receive facility grants. But usually this is the first 3 years of operation. And then there's the school district law, which is incorporated by reference into the charter school law, so also applies to charter schools, again, regarding conflict of interest. Now, all three of these laws agree that if a charter school board member is an employee of a for-profit organization with which the school does business, that, yes, that's a conflict of interest, and it's not allowed. However, if the school board member is an employee of a nonprofit organization, the charter school law says that that's not a conflict of interest. Well, it's not prohibited. That relationship needs to be disclosed to the Department of Education, but it's not prohibited. While the other two laws say, yeah, that's a conflict of interest. Only the federal charter school law says that an immediate family member providing contracted services is a conflict of interest. And then none of the laws address conflicts of interest regarding sponsors. And for that, we're talking about where a charter school leases facilities from a sponsor. And we saw that in a couple of the site visits that we visited, where the charter school leases facilities from the sponsor. And so it's a financial relationship that's separate from the charter school sponsor relationship. So there's a couple of points here on this table. First of all, the laws are at odds with each other. Secondly, the Minnesota charter school law is the weakest. And then third, none of them address sponsors. So we're going to have some recommendations that I'll tell you about in just a minute on those. But before I do that, we had also some concerns about the requirement that teachers comprise a majority on charter school boards. Minnesota is the only state that requires a teacher majority on charter school boards. And this contradicts best practices for organizational governance. The Council of Nonprofit recommends that no more than one staff person be on the board of an organization. And, of course, charter schools are incorporated as nonprofits or cooperatives, so that's a relevant best practice. Also, when we spoke to people, they talked about how this requirement leads to circular oversight. So during the day, the director oversees the charter school, oversees the teachers, and then in the evening they go to the board meeting and the teachers oversee the director. So it's really quite circular. And finally, this arrangement makes it difficult for some charter schools to obtain needed expertise, like financial or legal or organizational expertise on their board. One charter school we visited has 5 teachers, so it's quite small. By law, charter school boards must have 5 members. So 5 members, 3 of them have to be teachers. All right, well, the school has 5 teachers, one of whom is the director. So 3 of the 4 remaining teachers have to serve on the board, whether or not they want to. And we heard people say that they'd rather not serve on the board or that they were burned out or tired. And then this school had a kind of more general concern, which is, well, we only have 2 spots that aren't filled by teachers where we can get all the expertise that we might need to help us run our organization. I will also note that charter schools can apply for a waiver to this requirement. So by law, charter schools must have this teacher majority in place by the end of their 3rd year. But they can apply for a waiver to the department. But since January 2007, the department has approved 14 of these waivers but denied 15 of the waivers. So even though the waiver process is available, it's not always granted to all schools that want it. So we had a couple of recommendations regarding school boards and all these conflicts of interest. First, we think the legislature should expand Minnesota's conflict of interest laws that apply to charter schools to match the federal requirements. Those are the strongest requirements, and we think that charter schools should be held to those all the time, not just when they're receiving federal funds. We also think the legislature should expand the conflict of interest provisions to address relationships with sponsors. Now, we're not saying that there shouldn't at all be a relationship with sponsors, but we do think that relationship should be disclosed to the department, and any relationships outside of the traditional charter school sponsor contract should be entered into cautiously. We also think the legislature should remove the requirement that charter schools follow the school district conflict of interest laws. If you follow the first recommendation, which would be expanding the charter school conflict of interest laws, you won't need to incorporate these other ones by reference. And secondly, it's confusing to have these sets of laws in 2 different places. People weren't clear on what they were supposed to be following. And we think if all the conflict of interest laws are in one place, it's more likely to have higher compliance. Finally, we recommend removing the requirement that teachers comprise a majority of charter school boards. We're not saying that there can't be a majority. We're just saying it shouldn't be required. This is a recommendation we made in our 2003 report, and we're making it again here. So these recommendations, along with that oversight recommendation I mentioned earlier, are kind of the key recommendations in the report, although there are some others sprinkled throughout. There's a letter at the back of the report from the department, and I know the department reps are here, and they support our recommendations as well. So with that, I'll end the formal part of the presentation. I'm happy to take questions. Thank you.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Randall, thank you for your report and for your work. I wanted to get some clarification going back to the performance issue that you talked about, and you said that you tried to do some things to make a legitimate comparison between charter schools and regular district schools, and I'm wondering, was there any did you take a look at the years of existence that a charter school may have been working as a factor in the performance? In other words, if you have a school that is just beginning, they may not have maybe the experience, or they may not even have fully expanded their enrollment to.
Sure.
I mean, was that a factor in your comparison, or was that not taken into account?
Ms. Rand.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, we did look to see if there was a relationship there, and we didn't find one.
Okay.
That was my big theory, actually, that there would be a link there, and that was wrong.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Randall, were you able to draw any conclusions about who are better sponsors, who are checking more? Because we have higher ed institutions, independent school districts. Both groups are, you know, very rooted in being fiscally responsible. So were you able to draw any conclusions there as to who is checking on their charter school, and is it among these that are responsible for their own finances?
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, our information is largely from our site visits. So, you know, we visited 10 of the site visits and 14 of the charter schools. So I don't know that we can make grand conclusions from that, but I will say that there were better and less good sponsors of all different types. and the nonprofit organizations that sponsored, that we visited, had some of the strongest oversight more consistently than the other types of sponsors. But there were good sponsors in all the types, and also some not so good ones.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about your recommendations. And among the three sort of major stakeholders, the schools, the sponsors, and the Department of Education, did you get any feedback as to any of these recommendations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, regarding the structure of the structure recommendations?
Right. Correct.
Yeah, the Department of Education seems to be in support of the recommendation, and they're here and they can speak to that. And their letter at the back of the report also says that the recommendation, the option that we put forward as our recommendation, where sponsors would have to be approved, they say that that's, you know, worthy of consideration, and they're going to talk with everybody. One thing I didn't mention in the survey, so I'm happy for the – or didn't mention the presentation, so I'm happy for the question, is that in the survey that we sent out to sponsors in charter schools, 90% of the sponsors that responded said that they would like to be held accountable to some standards to be sponsors. And charter schools also, 90% of them, or almost 90%, also agree that sponsors should be held accountable. So I think across the board it seems that this would be a welcome recommendation, but I'm sure that there'll be subsequent conversations on that point.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, I think there are really two reasons that we wanted a report on charter schools, and one was to make sure that we had academic achievement accountability, and then financial accountability. And I'd just like to talk about the financial accountability a little more. We have seen some charter schools go under because of financial problems. And we've adjusted lease aid, done different things to try and make them solvent. And what were you seeing as you reviewed their cases individually that were causing financial problems? When did they run into trouble? Was it over expectations when they started their school that their enrollment would be higher? What was causing financial trouble for those that you might have seen?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, regarding the financial stuff, there's a table. Let me see if I can find it. It's in towards the back of Chapter 2, Table 2.8 on page 32, that gives kind of a high-level overview of the financial performance. And really what we found is that charter schools and district schools in the past 5 years seem to have pretty comparable financial health. So the problems that we saw with our 2003 evaluation on charter school financial accountability seem to be, I wouldn't say totally solved, but there seems to have been a lot of improvement there. In terms of why charter schools were struggling financially, what we heard was mostly anecdotal, and it did seem to be a lot of misjudging enrollment numbers, and so some and a little bit of kind of cash flow and cash management in the first couple of years. So it was more kind of the getting started aches and pains, but that was pretty anecdotal.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Randall, just in your review with sponsors and in your discussions with the sponsoring organizations, were there specific recommendations that sponsors had that were unique to their role that they brought forward in terms of what kind of oversight should they be given or what kind of authority, or were there other specific things that the sponsors brought that were independent of the interests of maybe the department or the schools themselves?
Sure.
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Senator Han, it's an interesting question, and I'm trying to reflect back because we had so many conversations. We definitely heard from sponsors about frustration of the duplication of effort with the charter school application process. And in some cases, I think that was justified. We didn't go through the application and second guess anyone's decision. But some of these sponsors really had very rigorous processes and were successful sponsors. And then the application was not approved by the department. And you know, I'm sure the department had its reasons. So there was some frustration there regarding the duplication of effort. Again, a lot of sponsors said that they would like to have some, again, my words, not theirs, but accreditation process, you know, being held accountable. And sponsors who were serious about it welcomed that level of accountability, but then kind of some of the freedom that maybe would go with that. And I guess some of the sponsors who said that they didn't have the ability maybe to do the, you know, oversee financial performance, I think probably some of them would like training. I don't know if all of them would want to be doing that, though. You know, I don't know that all of them would say, yeah, if we did the training on that, then that would be great. Some of them maybe just wouldn't want that piece of the oversight role. I don't know if that really answers. I mean, we heard lots of different stories and lots of different levels of interest in sponsoring. Some sponsors that have been sponsoring for a long time, but just maybe one or two schools, you know, they're not as active in their sponsoring role anymore, as opposed to some of maybe the newer sponsors.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Randall, what degree of satisfaction did you find among teachers, and I don't know if you interviewed students or parents, but are they happy with this choice that we have now had in Minnesota since the early 90s?
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, we were able to talk to some teachers, especially those who served on boards when we did site visits, and we spoke to some parents at one school. There was kind of a parent meeting, And yeah, they seem happy with their choice, but they're also the ones who are still there. You know, we weren't able to talk to students or teachers who maybe had gone to a charter school and then left. So we don't know that half of the story. But the people who were there did seem happy with it for lots of different reasons.
And Mr. Chair, follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Randall, is there any data available on turnover among teachers and students? I mean, is anyone tracking that? Does MDE do that, or does the organization itself do that?
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, regarding staff turnover, I don't have the information. The department might have that. Regarding student turnover and student mobility, we did some looking into that. That's on, let me see, pages 26 and 27 in the report. There's a whole piece about student mobility, And we were really quite surprised by the level of mobility in some charter schools. You can see on table 2.4, which is on page 26, 13% of charter schools statewide and actually 23% of charter schools in Minneapolis had over 100% mobility in 2007. Now, that doesn't mean the whole student population turned over, but it means that some of those seats had a lot of churn. And, again, that was one of the factors we found related to academic performance. And so some of this turnover, I think, is really I was pretty startled by it. The other thing I would just add is that schools, both charter and district schools, that had high mobility, the 50% or more, mm-hmm. They were more likely to maintain their enrollment or increase their enrollment. So having a lot of mobility doesn't necessarily mean you were losing all your kids, in other words. It just means there was a lot of churn. And based on the data we had there in 2.4, you can see that it's more pronounced in charter schools than district schools.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask a different question, but on that point about the turnover in the charter schools, do you think it's because parents are just making choices, or are they actually moving away? Or why do you think we're having such big turnover in some schools?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, our information on that is anecdotal. I mean, we heard all sorts of different reasons. One school referred to their lily padders, you know, just students who go from school to school to school for a variety of reasons. Some students get pregnant during the middle of the school year and might leave school or change schools to an online school, for example. Some might move, or their families might move. Some charter schools talked about, and again, this is all anecdotal, but some charter schools talked about their neighborhood district schools. If a student's maybe not working out so well in the district school, maybe strongly suggesting that they check out their local charter school. So I think there's a lot of different reasons. And some schools or students, I'm sure it's parent choice. Like, something's not working out well for them in the district school, let's try something new. I'm sure as many ideas you can think of are the reasons why it's happening.
I actually have one more.
Senator Roebling.
One of the reasons we started charter schools was to provide unique educational opportunities, something different than was offered in the regular public schools. And I'm wondering, as you checked around and looked at the various charter schools, are you seeing them actually live out their charter, the thing that they were approved for? Are they staying focused on that unique educational opportunity, or have some of them become like other public schools?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, from what we could see, and we did not compare actual practice to their original charter, so I can't say definitively, but there's certainly schools out there that are engaging in unique educational practices, absolutely. And there are some charter schools out there that look a lot like some district schools. So there's variation. I mean, as Mr. Noble said in the beginning, you've seen one charter school. There's all sorts of different types of innovation. And actually, in the report, we mentioned the purposes for charter schools that are outlined in law. We just have it on pages 5 and 6 outlined. And, you know, there's 6 different purposes that were identified in law for charter schools. And some of them are about innovation for learning, but not all of them. And a charter school just really needs to, by law, only needs to meet one of those purposes. So there's some innovation, yeah, and then there's some that I would say is probably not as innovative as maybe people who started charter schools thought.
Yeah.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have 2 questions. One, just going back to the mobility issue briefly.
Sure.
Did you find any relationship between the mobility and, again, how long the school has been in existence? In other words, if a school has gotten more established and its mission has become more clear to the community, has that mobility reduced, or was there not any discoverable relationship between those things?
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, that's a good question. I'm not sure that it's not in the report. I'll have to look back and see if we've done that, but I'll follow up with you on that.
Okay. And then, Mr. Senator Chair, it's on another topic, Ms. Randall, just your recommendation about the teacher majority requirement, and you mentioned that this was a recommendation that the office had made in 2003. In this audit, were you able to find anything specific that would relate to performance, either fiscal or academic, that would be related to the teacher majority provisions? In other words, is that a structure that tends to manifest itself in detectable problems, or is it just more a principle of good governance that you're raising here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, in this report, it's more based on good governance and then what we heard about getting expertise and schools really wanting to have that flexibility. In our previous evaluation in 2003, we did find examples of where it led to some financial difficulty. It was harder for teachers to maybe cut their salaries, things like that. So we have a history, I think, in our evaluations of finding both actually tangible things and good government reasons why that requirement should go away.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Randall, I'm just reading about the academic performance and just wondering, because really, you have to look at testing to see for the performance. I'm wondering if you talked with any of the teachers or if they felt that the regular Minnesota schools, district schools, teach more to the test than a charter school, if that ever came into the discussion at all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ruth, what I heard mostly were the fact that the MCAs don't measure the growth or the progress of a student. So, you know, the state standardized test measures against the state standards. So if a student comes to a charter school 3 grade levels behind, by the time of the test, they may only be 1 grade level behind, but they're still behind. And so that 2 grade levels that charter school has brought that student up in that year isn't going to be captured in the test. So what we heard more was dissatisfaction with the measuring tool rather than the methods of other schools and their teaching.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Randall, did any of the schools cite what was most difficult about fiscal management of a charter school?
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, thinking. I know some charter schools talked about in the beginning, you know, estimating enrollment. And, of course, you know, the revenue is all tied to student enrollment, as you well know. And so if you're off even just a little bit for a small school, mm-hmm. it can be a big problem. I think that was probably the biggest one. A little bit of cash flow concerns, but it seemed to me, the early years were the hardest. And, again, I think that's kind of getting up to being able to understand your enrollments, project your enrollments, and getting established. There's a lot to learn. I mean, I admire the people who endeavor to start up a charter school. It's a lot of work.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Ms. Randall, one of the things the legislature was grappling with last session was the extracurricular activities for charter school students, and if they didn't have programs within their own schools, where they should belong, or could they belong in their home district or the district where the charter school was located. Did anyone bring that up? Because we didn't resolve it, really, and so I'm wondering, we'll be looking at it again next year.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, a couple of schools, the schools where I heard it discussed were the schools that actually had a basketball program or had their own athletic program and how proud they were of that and how successful that had been. No. Other than that, we didn't hear a lot of complaints about it, but we also, our questions weren't geared towards that, so our questions might not have invited much conversation on that point.
Any other questions? I have a follow-up just on, you know, Ms. Randall, we read in the paper the score results. I think they were in the paper this morning,
yeah.
And then we have the report today. And as policymakers or as parents, how are we, I mean, looking through the report, we're not going to see a charter school by and sponsor because it's a summary document. And maybe if you wanted to just highlight that and tell us how should we measure this? I mean, how should we as policymakers look at what we read in the paper, all the other reports we get, and then this report?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Mr. Chair, members, I think the bottom line is that performance is mixed, but there's room for improvement. You know, I mean, I know that's kind of a generic statement, but I think that's really what we see in the paper and what we see in the report is, you know, some district and charter schools are doing great and some aren't doing great. And and I think as a state, you know, we've got these standards that we expect all students to meet. And so I think we need to keep pushing to figure out the way to do that. I wish I had the magic answer. I don't know. Are you chomping at the bit?
Mr. Nobles.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I would add in part, take us back to the discussion about the limitations of tests, the snapshot critique of the test that we use. And yes, that is a limitation in our evaluation of charter schools, but it's a limitation in our evaluation of district schools as well. And we need mechanisms for gathering or for measuring growth. But I think as a policy matter, both at the federal and at the state level, we have to decide, are we going to have a minimum standard that we expect all students and all schools to meet? The answer to that question now is yes. And I think people would point to some good results from that policy choice. and people will point to some challenges and difficulties and even some unfairness that that imposes on some schools and some children. But that is the policy that we've adopted, and it affects the results that we have here for you on charter schools. I guess specifically on the data that came out today, I think it is important that people remember that this is a set of general conclusions. And if you want to know about the charter school in your district or maybe the charter school that you're thinking of sending your children to, you need to look at the specifics because the specifics matter, and they vary. And academic performance is going to be only one piece of the choice that families and children make. There was reference to the unique experience that some charter schools offer. There are many factors that go in, but I think the fact that Minnesota is offering choice, particularly, I might add, choice in some districts in the urban area where the district schools are quite challenged, and the results here show that to some degree, the charter school offers an attractive option, shall we say. And I think that's a good thing. So although this isn't a ringing endorsement of the success of the academic performance of charter schools, I think it simply shows that this is difficult to do. There's no reason to end this, but there's reason to take lessons, to go forward, and make improvements.
Thank you. As a commission meeting, we provide the opportunity for the agency to respond, and we have Morgan Brown with the Assistant Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Education.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Morgan Brown with the Department of Education. My comments are really just going to try to summarize the commissioner's response to the OLA's report, which you'll find at the back of the report beginning on page 73. The commissioner divided up her comments into a response on financial performance of charter schools, so the specific responses of the department to the recommendations you heard about regarding oversight of charter schools, and then also the findings regarding academic performance of charter schools. Overall, the commissioner was very appreciative of the thorough review of the program conducted by OLA staff, especially with regard to charter school oversight. On financial performance of charter schools, as you heard referenced earlier, we were very pleased with the conclusion that charter schools' financial health is comparable to that of school districts now. That's a clear reversal of the finding that the OLA had in its 2003 report on charter school financial accountability. And as a department, we've discovered that not only collectively has charter school financial performance improved, but we see a greater number of charter schools that are demonstrating exemplary financial management practices. We started a school finance award at the department in 2003, and in the most recent year, 2008, 43 of the 96 awards that went out to either school districts or charter schools went to charter schools. So about 45% of the school finance awards went to charter schools this year. Finally, on a related note, we appreciated the OLA's finding that the Department of Education has implemented a number of recommendations that were presented in the 2003 financial accountability report by the OLA. On the recommendations for charter school oversight, as you already heard OLA staff reference, the department is generally supportive of all of the recommendations the OLA is making, and we intend to work both with charter school stakeholders and legislators in the interim and prior to the 2009 session to see if we can develop legislative proposals in response to those recommendations. On recommendation number one, which had to do with clarifying the roles of the department and charter school sponsors, we find many aspects of what was called option one in the report, increasing sponsors' authority, to be worthy of consideration, and that's the one the OLA stated a preference for as well. We had some concerns, frankly, about both option two and option three, whether those were appropriate solutions, and I can answer any questions people might have about that. On recommendation number two, which had to do with implementing standards for charter school sponsors, the commissioner noted that since 2004, the department has implemented a number of projects and activities to improve the quality of sponsorship, primarily by taking a strategy of disseminating effective practices about sponsorship and then providing a variety of technical assistance and training opportunities for sponsors. And there's an attachment to the letter that lists all of those. In addition, although the department does review the capacities of each sponsor as part of the individual school application process, as OLA staff referenced, We don't believe that we currently have the legislative authority to establish some kind of minimum standards outside of the basic eligibility requirements for sponsors that are specified in the law. So we believe that this particular recommendation does have merit, especially in combination with the option one I just referenced in the OLA's first recommendation, and we would welcome any rulemaking authority to develop rigorous standards should the legislature choose to grant it. On recommendation three, which relates to providing financial management training, again, the commissioner notes that since 2003, the department has significantly expanded its financial management training for both board members and directors, and you'll see a summary of those also attached to the letter. But we do support the OLA's recommendation to the legislature to require all new charter school board members to attend financial management training, which, of course, is required for the department to provide. Currently, we do require all board members of new charter schools that are starting up to attend financial training, and we have leverage to do so through the federal grant. But we don't have in the statute, although we're required to provide financial training for all board members, there's no requirement that for operational charter schools that are already up and running, that those new board members that come on board attend that financial training. Finally, on recommendations four and five, the ones that deal with conflict of interest laws, and also removing the requirement that teachers comprise a majority of charter school board members. We strongly support both of those recommendations, and the commissioner references that we've been on record in supporting those previously as well. Finally, a word about academic performance of charter schools. We think it's important that the OLA report, and this goes back to a question Senator Roebling referenced, found that, quote, charter schools have increased educational choices for Minnesota students, unquote, and that overall these students are serving higher percentages of students of color, children from low-income families, and English language learners than district schools. And to us, this is a significant confirmation that collectively these schools are fulfilling an important purpose of the charter school law, which was to provide more educational choices, particularly to underserved students. Given the fundamental chartering concept of increased school autonomy and flexibility in exchange for greater accountability, the commissioner takes very seriously the measure of academic performance in charter schools, and we appreciate the OLA's efforts to account for a number of demographic and other factors in comparing academic performance in charter and district schools, as well as the inclusion of several cautionary statements regarding interpretation of this analysis. While the OLA's evaluation of academic performance certainly provides a basis for further inquiry, the department cautions that it is difficult to infer any causal relationship between students' enrollment in a charter or district school and those students' academic results using 1 year's worth of data. And this is especially important, as was referenced, for charter school students, since the vast majority of those students come and transfer into charter schools from other public schools and have been there for widely varying periods of time. Finally, the department has made it a priority to provide student assessment data that will allow more sophisticated evaluations of a school's impact on student academic performance over time as MDE implements its growth model for measuring student progress on the MCA 2 exams. And for charter schools specifically, we have taken the step of signing a shared data agreement with the respected Center for Research on Educational Outcomes out of Stanford University. And as a result, those researchers will have the opportunity to have access to student data and protect student data privacy as required by federal and state law. They will be able to conduct a multi-year longitudinal analysis of students' academic performance in charter schools as compared to the performance of similar students in district schools. Thanks very much. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for coming before the commission. Sure. I have a question for you that's similar to the one we're all going to get asked if we press ahead with legislation that embodies these changes, and that has to do with cost. Are any of these either cost prohibitive measures in terms of the Department of Education, or do any of them give you pause in terms of the cost of implementing these new oversight structures in particular?
Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the one thing we'll have to spend some time looking at, and again, the OLA may want to respond to this as well, this option one of providing more authority to sponsors by setting up a situation where we provide minimum standards or rigorous standards, at least rigorous minimum standards for sponsors that they have to meet before they can even – they have to pass before they can even become a sponsor, and then they sponsor schools in turn. There's obviously kind of a transitional process we'll have to go through from the current system to that, and there may be some pieces related to that that we just – haven't fully explored what would be the cost in terms of staff resources. In the report and in that recommendation, the OLA does talk a lot about they've kind of visualized a little bit what those transitional steps might be.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. When you talk about setting more rigorous standards, as they did in the report, do you think that would be a deterrent for finding sponsors? Because I think sometimes that may have been a problem in the past for some schools that wanted to get started, that they had difficulty finding sponsors. If we make it a lot more difficult to get into it, do you think we'll have more trouble?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, it will definitely shrink the number of sponsors currently available for charter schools. Maybe that's part of the purpose of the recommendation. I would say, as of now, in terms of the department's assessment of those sponsors that have pretty rigorous sponsorship models, which is probably a group of 10 to 15 generally, they currently are sponsoring the majority of schools because they're the most active, engaged sponsors. So the sponsors that would probably fall by the wayside would likely be the ones that OLA staff referred to that it's a maybe a sponsor that only got in the business to sponsor one or two schools and is not actively pursuing additional sponsorship of schools. So it's hard to predict what the impact would be on continued growth in the charter school sector, but clearly there would be some current sponsors that would not meet rigorous standards in the way that we've discussed them.
Mr. Chair, if I could just also add, and Senator Roebling, the intent of the recommendation was not to shrink the number of sponsors. It was simply just to make sure all those who are sponsoring are doing what they're expected to do. But I would concur with what Mr. Brown said in that the most active sponsoring organizations do sponsor a lot of them. In the report, we show it by type, and I think it's like nonprofit organizations that are sponsor 45% of the charter schools, and many of the smaller, the ones that seem less involved are the ones that do just sponsor one or two.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you. Commissioner, I'm looking at the table just on this, on page 7, schools have opened and closed and so forth. And when the legislative auditor reviewed this with report in 2003, it looked like up through in the years immediately preceding that report, about 14 schools had closed. And it now looks like another 14 have closed, you know, from 2003 until now. Is there any reason, is it other than financial, or is there anything that we can be doing to monitor these things? Because it's obviously hard on everybody when one of these things gets approved and then ultimately closes down. And as I said, we've just had 14 that have closed, I think, since the last report. What more can we be doing to watch this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, two responses to that. One, of course, we've seen an incredible growth in the number of charter schools from about 2001 to 2002. In fact, I believe the Center for School Change put out a report earlier this week that the number of students in charter schools has tripled since then. So we have a lot more charter schools out there, so there's a larger pool to begin with. The other argument I'd make is that, frankly, that some sponsors, at least, are becoming serious about closing charter schools that don't perform. And we've had, and this has not happened, actually, in all other states, but here in Minnesota, we have been serious about schools that don't perform academically in some cases and don't perform financially will be closed, and that was part of the charter school concept. And I think as we've developed sponsoring, which we really did a lot of in the last 6, 7, 8 years, in the 90s, I think everyone would agree we didn't have a concept of how important quality sponsoring was to having quality schools. And since we've ramped up the efforts to help and provide assistance to sponsors, they've been willing to take more action in terms of holding schools accountable.
Senator Betzel.
Then, Commissioner, do we have a sense of, are there schools out there on the horizon that are kind of on the bubble that the sponsors are getting concerned about them? Are we facing other closures that you're aware of?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, again, you'll see that it varies from year to year. One thing that has actually helped in terms of the issue of charter school closures just because of cash flow, basic kind of financial performance issues, is the improvement in charter school financial performance overall. So in general, fortunately, we're seeing not as many closures early on or problems early on or mid-year closures, which are always an example of when you really have problems that you didn't deal with, is when you have a school close abruptly in the middle of the year. We haven't had that for several years. I mean, for instance, this year there is, to my knowledge, currently only one charter school that is closing due to financial performance or other management concerns at the end of this school year.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Mr. Nobles?
Mr. Chairman, thanks again to the department and all the folks in the audience and the members of the commission for your attention to this report. We'll obviously be presenting it to committees of jurisdiction and look forward to those discussions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nobles mentioned committees of jurisdiction, and generally the Audit Commission takes comments from Mr. Nobles on a report and then provides opportunity to the agency to respond, and the committees of jurisdiction hear public testimony and follow-up, and that's our general process and procedure. The next item on the agenda is earlier this spring we had a meeting where we discussed issues relating to the Attorney General's office, and on June 3rd, Mr. Nobles provided the members of the commission with a response. And Mr. Nobles, if you want to go through this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. As the chairman noted, on March 28th, the Legislative Audit Commission discussed certain specific allegations about the Attorney General's office. All of those allegations were prefaced with the statement that attorneys, both current and former, some attorneys, in the Attorney General's office had expressed that they felt pressure to do certain things that they thought were inappropriate. The commission discussed those allegations and decided that you would leave it to the Office of the Legislative Auditor to conduct what we refer to as a preliminary assessment, which we do quite frequently when we receive allegations. The two principal questions in a preliminary assessment are, is there credible evidence to support the allegations? In other words, is there some reasonable basis in fact? Not that someone has to come in and prove the allegations, but is there some reasonable basis to believe that they're credible? And then the second question is, do those allegations fall within the jurisdiction of the Office of the Legislative Auditor? Now, as I said, we conduct a lot of preliminary assessments throughout the year. We take in any allegation from any source, and we conduct a preliminary assessment. Sometimes they don't take a great deal of time. Sometimes they can take several days or even weeks. But in this case, this was quite an extensive preliminary assessment. In fact, it bordered on itself being an investigation, but we still characterized it because of the limited nature of it as a preliminary assessment. But we did interview a lot of people, both current and former attorneys in the Attorney General's office. We also conducted 7 interviews under oath that were recorded and transcribed. The conclusions we reached were, first, that testimony, particularly the testimony from people under oath, they were people with firsthand knowledge, that it corroborated and confirmed that indeed there are attorneys, again, both former and current, that felt pressured to do things that they thought were inappropriate. But on the second jurisdictional issue, we felt that these questions really fell outside of the typical issues that the Legislative Auditor's Office pursues in an investigation. And you will recall that when we first discussed the allegations, I laid out for you the ways in which the Office of the Legislative Auditor can proceed with an inquiry or review. And let me just quickly mention those again. You're very familiar, obviously, with our evaluations, which can only be done if they're approved by the Legislative Audit Commission. But the Legislative Audit Commission has a tradition, it is not a matter of law, but of tradition, to not approve program evaluations or management evaluations of constitutional offices. I think the reason for that is that these officials are accountable directly to the voters, their political offices to some degree, to greater and lesser degrees, and I think the Commission has simply felt over the years that they did not want to subject those offices to an evaluation, a management study by the Legislative Auditor. But that was an option that was set forth when we initially discussed the allegations. One of the other avenues of an inquiry is the authority that the Legislative Auditor can exercise unilaterally. And that authority says the Legislative Auditor shall see that all provisions of law respecting the appropriate and economic use of public funds are complied with, and may, as part of a financial audit or separately, investigate allegations of noncompliance by employees of departments and agencies of the state government. So that's what we receive typically. As we receive allegations, that's the authority that we typically use, the unilateral authority of the legislative auditor. But it is somewhat narrow in that it is specifically tied to allegations concerning compliance with finance-related laws. The other provision that I referenced when you considered the allegations was a more open-ended one. But again, it required action by the Legislative Audit Commission. And that provision says, in addition to the legislative auditing duties concerning state financial matters, the legislative auditor shall also exercise and perform duties prescribed by rule of the legislature or either body or by the commission. So a motion was made that you, the Legislative Audit Commission, direct the legislative auditor to conduct an investigation under that provision of statute, which would have been fairly open-ended. When that motion was withdrawn, we did revert to the more limited jurisdiction. So, again, I emphasize that in this preliminary assessment, we were, of necessity, having to determine whether or not the allegations fit within that jurisdiction. We decided that the allegations did not. As you recall, the substance of the allegations, and there were five, related to matters such as attorneys feeling pressure to include unsubstantiated material in an affidavit, or to feeling pressure to issue a civil investigative demand without merit, or being pressured to make favorable comments toward the Attorney General on a blog, or finding citizens that were willing to be participants in a lawsuit that would be brought by the Attorney General. So that was the nature of the allegations. And again, we felt that they did not fit within this jurisdiction. Cecile Ferkel, who I apologize for not introducing earlier, the Deputy Legislative Auditor, participated with me in taking all of the statements under oath, the seven. And I think that we agreed, and I would certainly ask for her comments on this, that not only did the allegations not fall clearly within this jurisdictional boundary that I just read to you about compliance with financial-related matters, but the nature of the allegations also were somewhat subjective, and I referred to some of this in my letter. That is, that the pressure itself was not necessarily the result of direct threats, but a sense of attorneys were working in an environment in which they might be reprimanded, they might be fired, they might be transferred, they might be harmed in some way if they reacted negatively towards a suggestion from the Attorney General or some other management figure in the office. That is a somewhat subjective feeling that someone has if it isn't a direct threat, that they're working in an environment where they may be subject to that kind of retaliation. And I think some of the substance of what people were being asked to do also had some subjectivity to it. As I said, people alleged that they had felt pressured to include within an affidavit material that they had not corroborated. But as we took testimony on that issue, we found that some of that material related to information from other legal pleadings from other jurisdictions, other attorneys generals in other states had included that material. Yet some attorneys in the Minnesota Attorney General's office felt that was inappropriate to simply by reference include material if it could not be substantiated that those violations had occurred in Minnesota. I think those are somewhat matters of judgment. They are somewhat subjective in terms of whether or not there's a real impropriety. I think the issue, for example, of asking someone to blog favorable comments toward an elected official also has some elements of subjectivity to it. It's certainly something many of us in this room might feel is inappropriate, but I'm not sure that there is a law related to that, that it's illegal or unethical even for an elected official, a constitutional officer, or other elected officials to ask those that work for them to put favorable comments on a blog. So those are the reasons why we felt that there really wasn't anything additional for us to do. Again, we confirmed that these allegations have credibility. There certainly are attorneys, former and present, who feel that they have been pressured to do things that they felt were inappropriate. But even if there were not the jurisdictional question, I'm not sure what more there is for us to investigate. And I'll just add one other comment, and that is, you know, we did not question the sincerity of the people who came forth to give us this testimony. In fact, I think Ms. Ferkel and I both would tell you that we were impressed with the credibility and the sincerity of these people. They felt very passionately about the situation in the Attorney General's office. And frankly, some of them had quite strong condemnations. But a lot of this had to do with the person or persons who have either been or are currently the Attorney General and their management styles, their way of running the office. And as I referenced in the letter, there was a feeling among these people that both former Attorney Mike Hatch and current Attorney General Lori Swanson put far too much emphasis on press conferences, over going out and getting cases and holding press conferences for political advantage, frankly. And people that we talked to felt that that was excessive and that they wanted to work in an environment that was less political, more professional, and nonpartisan. Those, I think, are not questions for the legislative auditor to address. Frankly, some people felt, aside from the nature of the Attorney General's office, the person, him or herself, was simply the inappropriate person to be the Attorney General. Again, I don't know what part the legislative auditor should have in that discussion. Therefore, I concluded that we had done our job, and we bring this back to you, and we can certainly answer any questions, but would you like to add? Cecile can certainly answer questions about the testimony that we received, but I think that pretty much sums up. Oh, there is one other thing. We did hear allegations of certain issues that were not brought forth to the Legislative Audit Commission, and we have and will continue to pursue those.
Members, any questions? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Nobles and Ms. Ferkel. I appreciate your report. I think it's judicious. It's well-reasoned. I know it's a product of a lot of hard work by a lot of people, so I appreciate that. One thing I'm intrigued with in particular is on the last page you make what I would call sort of suggestions for inquiry, not so much recommendations, if there is a distinction, but a suggestion about civil service status in the Attorney General's office. And I know I'm using that word suggestion. It's my own, not yours. But it seems to be at least that in terms of investigating how we might reach some sort of accommodation. My word, not yours. I mean, I know one thing that we said at the last hearing, and I still maintain this position. I can't speak for my colleagues here, was that I am glad that you and your office did not get involved with this other sort of sideshow issue of the unionization effort, which I saw as separate and distinct, and I'm glad that you went to great pains, I think, in your report to say that you stayed away from that. But it does seem to me, based on the statistics that you had in there and just based on what I've heard and I think some of us have heard, that one possible middle ground between full-bore unionization and the current system where all attorneys and investigators serve at the pleasure or at the will of the Attorney General, one possible accommodation or middle ground might be civil service protection, not unionization, but civil service protection. I think you gave some statistics as to other state offices. Do you care to comment on that, or am I elevating what you said to a level that it doesn't deserve? I call it a suggestion, but not.
No,
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon, I really appreciate you bringing that point because I didn't mention it. It is a part of the letter, and I think it really is an important point, and frankly, the way forward, in my view, towards some legislative discussion of the concerns about the Attorney General's office. As I said, I think that there are many issues involved here, from ones that I think can fairly be characterized as personal, as political. And I think those are completely legitimate. My only concern is I didn't see what my role should be in those. But I do believe there is a very legitimate role, not only for the Legislative Auditor's Office in making this suggestion, but to you as the legislature to consider issues within the Attorney General's office that might impact the performance of the office overall. And so I made the suggestion, again, abiding by the admonition of the commission not to get involved in the unionization issue, but seeing, again, that all of the attorneys that came forth and testified, both the ones on the record and that I talked to off the record, all of them referred to the fact that they felt the pressure because they had no protection, that they were working as at-will employees. And they felt that that undermined their ability to put forth professional judgments that might be in contradiction to a political position of the Attorney General. And so, I mean, I do look to these other constitutional offices that are also headed by elected officials, political figures in the state of Minnesota, and I find that even though a part of those offices, the Secretary of State's office and the State Auditor's office, could be considered a political office in that those two officials run for office on a party designation, and then they also have people that they can bring in and work at will, work at the pleasure of the elected official. By and large, most of the people who work in the Secretary of State's office and the State Auditor's office are classified employees. And I think that is because, and this is a determination the legislature has made, and I think you've made that determination because you look at those two offices and you say that those offices perform some functions that should be outside of politics and should have some insulation from politics. And since the offices are run by elected officials, you've given that protection to the people performing those governmental, non-political functions, the protection of the classified civil service. And so that's my suggestion to you, is that you consider whether that approach is the appropriate approach for the Attorney General's office. Now, the contrary argument is that the Attorney General's office is not like this Secretary of State's office or like the State Auditor's office, but it is much more like the Governor's office, which does not have classified employees. All of the employees in the Governor's office work at the pleasure of the Governor. They're political appointees. And I believe, having had some conversation with the Attorney General's office on this point, that they will take the position that their office, for a variety of reasons, is more analogous to the Governor's office than to the Secretary of State or State Auditor's office, and that indeed they will take the position that all of the attorneys should work at the pleasure of the Attorney General. I simply put this forth as I think a step forward for a legitimate legislative executive branch discussion of the issues that have been brought forth.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. I think that that's a discussion we probably don't need to have here, but maybe later next legislative session. I thank you and your office for that. I want to talk about one of the specific five allegations, because although I know you're constrained, both of you here at this hearing, by certain confidentiality requirements, because my understanding is all seven of the people who testified insisted upon strict confidentiality for fear of retaliation, reprisal, and the like. So I don't know the extent to which you can corroborate what I'm saying. And if you can't, just let me know that, and you can treat it as a rhetorical question. But I do think that with respect to some of these allegations, this one in particular, the one about the blogging, I think it really is a fine line. We obviously defer to your judgment on where it fell jurisdictionally. My understanding, your report doesn't talk about the details, but I know a number of us here, maybe all of us, have been contacted by some of these folks who did testify under oath. And my understanding of the allegation is that a particularly high-level person, well, it was Mike Hatch, when he was Lori Swanson's deputy in early part of 2007, asked directly or indirectly several employees, attorneys, to post favorable blog postings. In fact, he composed the blog postings, showed it to them, asked whether or not it would be okay to post and not. In one particular case, a person who at least says that he testified under oath before you but who does not want his name revealed, he says that he did not give permission for this pre-written statement to be posted on the blog. It was posted on the blog. And that afterwards, former Attorney General Hatch, now serving as the deputy, asked him to falsify his timesheet so that he could put in vacation time, so that if anyone was ever looking at the record, it would show so-and-so put half an hour or 15 minutes or whatever of vacation time, thereby sort of covering the rear end, not of the employee, but of Mr. Hatch, who actually posted it. That's the allegation, and my understanding, and if you want to treat this as a rhetorical question, you certainly may. My understanding is that the jurisdictional reason for not going further on that is it's a close call, but your call was that asking someone to take their vacation time is not really theft of state funds because that's something that belongs to the employee, not to the state, that accrued vacation time. Can you comment on that allegation?
Yes,
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon, I think all that you have just said is an accurate reflection of the testimony we received under oath. The person did say that they were approached by Mike Hatch and asked with a composed statement to put this statement on a blog. The person testified that they did not do that, but that the statement did appear and that Mr. Hatch acknowledged that he had put it there and did ask this person to, I don't know that I would use the term falsify. I think he made the request that the person use some of his leave time, I think it was 30 minutes, to account for the time that might have been spent if this person had actually blogged. The reason why I think there's some shade of gray is the reasons that you stated, Representative Simon. It is the individual, not the state, that has the right to the leave time. That is essentially vacation time that has been earned. Mr. Hatch, for example, or any other elected official could go to a staff person and say, you've built up 40, 80, however many hours of leave time. Would you be willing to take that and come out and campaign with me? Now, the person may feel like that's an inappropriate request for them to feel pressure to use their vacation time for politicking. That, I think, is in the nature of what Mr. Hatch requested. Now, in some environments, that may feel inappropriate, and to some people that may feel inappropriate. But it wouldn't technically be a use of state time, since the time itself is, in a sense, owned by the employee. And if he or she is willing to give it up to an elected official for a political purpose, that is their prerogative. I think you do get into somewhat of an ethical consideration. If the pressure is significant and great, in this case, I don't think it was in particular. And I would just add as the final note, as I'm sure you probably know, ultimately the person did not change his timesheet to reflect the 30 minutes of leave time for blogging. So on several scores, again, we felt that there was some subjectivity. But I would also add, Representative Simon, we have now just put pretty much on the record the whole story. And so, again, my consideration of what more is there to do, I guess I could go and get some corroboration, possibly under oath, from Mr. Hatch or others that, in fact, all of what has just been said is true. But I do have second-hand corroboration that it is. And first-hand statements under oath from the people who were involved that is all an accurate representation of what occurred.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, that brings to mind kind of an observation that really dawned on me, at least, for the first time here, in the context of that allegation, but others as well. And that is, I think we see this in every employment context, whether it's a school or a store or a government office. When a supervisor either tells an employee or pressures an employee to do something that is dishonest or unethical or even illegal, it can have the unintentional result of creating a win-win situation for that supervisor. Because if the employee buckles and complies, then the employee is complicit and is far less likely to report it because he or she is complicit, legally and otherwise. If, on the other hand, as in this case, the employee exercises his or her own conscience and doesn't comply, then the response tends to be, well, what's the big deal? It never happened. Yes, there was pressure to, but the person exercised their conscience, so the wrong wasn't done. And that's a more universal question than we have time to answer here, but it's just something that, that occurred to me, and it, it goes beyond this investigation, but it's really sort of an unfortunate circumstance, and I feel for some of the folks who apparently talked to you. I mean, and that's unfortunate. But there are a couple things I wanted to, Mr. Chair, go on to, if I may. You alluded to some other items that you did look into apart from these five specific allegations, and I think there's some public documents to that effect. I don't think they've been distributed to the public, but they are available upon request to the public. One in particular I understand that you looked into because others under oath told you about them had to do with the Capital One settlement. And again, please feel free at any point if I'm asking you to say something that you feel you're not able to talk about, then by all means, I guess. Okay, I've got a copy.
Maybe on just on that point, though, Mr. Nobles, on, you know, we've had you've taken testimony under oath, and you've had that. I would like you to just give a little bit about data before we delve into this particular thing. I'd like you to talk about data and private and public, and, you know, because we do have an agenda here of things we've got to go through. I'd like to just have some caution on what we can and cannot say.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, the seven people that we interviewed under oath and recorded and transcribed their testimony all asked for their identities to be protected, and we extended that protection to them. That is a provision of law that is afforded specifically to the legislative auditor. And to obtain their testimony, that was part of the agreement. And so all of that testimony, at least to the extent that any of it would identify them, is classified as private. But there are ways under the law, under the Government Data Practices Act, that some of this material in summary fashion can be discussed. And specifically as to the Capital One issue, I think that we can discuss that without revealing any identity. As I mentioned before, and as I mentioned in the letter, as a part of the preliminary assessment, a number of the people that testified to us presented some issues that were in addition to the ones presented to the Legislative Audit Commission. And some of them were related to financial matters. And anytime those kinds of issues are presented to the legislative auditor, we have an absolute obligation to consider them. But we have some choice as to how to proceed. And as I mentioned, whenever we receive an allegation, we go through a preliminary assessment and determine whether or not it has a credibility and falls within our jurisdiction. Even if an allegation meets that those two tests, it doesn't mean that we go out tomorrow and launch an investigation. We may decide that the best way to address the issue is through an upcoming audit. The statutory reference that I just read to you about the legislative auditor's responsibility, I would remind you, referred to the legislative auditor pursuing that alleged noncompliance either through a financial audit or an investigation. So, in considering some of the allegations that were in addition to the ones that were presented to you that were of a financial nature, we examined them all to some degree in the context of a preliminary assessment. And some of them, as I said, we have set aside. We haven't ignored them, but we've deferred our action on them. Some of them, some of you may have heard about, relate to the use of Medicaid money. We have an absolute responsibility under federal law to examine allegations of misuse of federal funds, and we will do that. I didn't feel that they were of the gravity that they required us to do it immediately under an investigation. We intend to go out and pursue those under our normal audit process, which goes on every year. So, and we can discuss those as well if you want, but referring back to the Capital One issue, it was alleged to us that there was a settlement agreement in the Capital One case that involved the Attorney General providing some of the settlement money to an organization called ACORN. And so we addressed a letter to the Attorney General asking a variety of questions as to the propriety of the settlement, the authority for the settlement, the legality of the settlement, and specifically referencing the justification for money going to ACORN, particularly in the context that shortly after the settlement was finalized, ACORN, an affiliate organization within an umbrella of many organizations that go by the name ACORN, endorsed my catch for governor. And I specifically asked the Attorney General to explain the propriety of settling a settlement that gave money to ACORN and the connection to the endorsement. And I received a response. I made that request to the Attorney General on May the 12th. I asked for a response, and by May 16th, I think they asked for a day or two in addition, and I received the response on May the 19th from Attorney General Swanson and former Attorney General Hatch. I don't think in this setting, Mr. Chairman, I'll go through the details of that. I think that the conclusion I would leave you with is that I think the responses that I received and that you certainly are entitled to see, they are public documents, will tell you that both former Attorney General Hatch and current Attorney General Swanson, who, by the way, at the time of this settlement, Ms. Swanson was the Solicitor General and negotiated the settlement with Capital One, they provided defense of the settlement, both as to its legality and propriety. You can make your own judgment about the about that defense and whether or not you think that there is additional investigative work or other work for the legislative auditor to do.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with you. This isn't the time, Mr. Nobles or Ms. Ferkel, to discuss the details other than for the benefit of the public to know. The allegation pertained to a Minnesota statute that says that, as I understand it anyway, that any settlement that is $750,000 and above must go to the general fund. And the allegation here is that there was the opportunity for a settlement higher than that, substantially higher than that. But instead, the case was settled for $749,999, with a third of it going to ACORN. I have read the responses here, one of which, the primary response seems to be that this was Capital One's idea. And although I don't think it's appropriate, given the reasons that you talked about necessarily today, to send you or your office on a more investigation, I think others, the answers here do beg at least as many questions as they answer. Whether it was Capital One's idea to give $250,000 to ACORN seems to be an objectively verifiable fact. And I notice there's an attorney on the pleadings at Fagrian Benson, and I'm sure he can be contacted. But I think it would be interesting to see whether that was in fact true, although that's beyond the purview here today. There was another allegation, I understand, that still is sort of in the hopper or is a live one, and that has to do, as you said, with Medicaid fraud. My understanding of that allegation, and I think a number of us here around the table have been contacted in recent days and weeks by folks who say at least that they have things to talk about pertaining to that. My understanding, and anyone here around the table who's heard from them can correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is that the way it works is that the federal government, at least in Minnesota, pays for about three-quarters of the cost of the Medicaid fraud division, the attorneys, the investigators, the support staff, the paper clips, what have you, under the obvious condition that all those resources be deployed only for Medicaid fraud cases, not cases involving the elderly or senior citizens in distress, but Medicaid fraud. In the allegation, at least, including by managerial personnel, either presently or formerly in that very division, is that that was not the case, and that stemming back as far back as 2005, there was a siphoning or diversion of resources in that office for non-Medicaid fraud purposes, particularly purposes, more headline-grabbing cases or cases outside the purview. And there was a certification to the federal government. All that money was being used for Medicaid fraud when that wasn't the case. That's the allegation. There's a sentence, I assume this is a reference to that allegation, in your report here. I see on page 3 at the bottom when you say, the few issues involving public funds that were presented to us during our preliminary assessment were assessed and resolved, or they will be addressed during our next financial audit of the Attorney General's office in early 2009. My question, that's a long-winded question, but the question is, could you describe to us, particularly those who are new to the LAC here, this idea of this regularly scheduled audit, not only for the Attorney General's office, but for other constitutional offices.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, several years ago, the Legislative Audit Commission set a policy on the frequency with which we would audit the constitutional offices. And again, I think that that showed some sensitivity towards these offices. Not that they are off limits. They clearly are within the jurisdiction of the legislative auditor to audit. And we do audit them, and we audit them twice within every term. And we audit them to some level of detail, I might add, in part because they're relatively small offices. But they do get regularly audited. But there was some concern that we could potentially be asked to audit them in the context of a campaign, and that even the commission itself could get involved in directing the legislative auditor to audit one of the constitutional offices at a time when the audit results could be seen as political. And to eliminate that possibility, the commission said for the legislative auditor to audit constitutional offices at the end of a term and at midterm of a four-year term. And so we audit each term twice in that sequence. It doesn't mean, by the way, that if there is good reason that we can't do supplementary additional work. I have, on several occasions, done investigations, preliminary assessments of constitutional offices. I did recently, for example, you may recall work we did at the Secretary of State's office. That was not in the sequence established by your policy, but it came under the legislative auditor's authority and responsibility to pursue allegations of potential misuse of public funds. And so even given that policy of the Legislative Audit Commission, I still reserve the prerogative under the statute to conduct investigations of the constitutional offices if there is, in my determination, good cause to do so.
Ms. Ferkel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I also want to add that there's our annual audit work that we do of federal compliance. Through the Department of Human Services, we spend quite a few hours, probably 3,000 audit hours, auditing the state's use of federal Medicaid money and whether or not it complies. A small element of that in terms of the total amount of expenditures in that area, small element of that is the Medicaid money that's spent through the Medicaid Fraud Unit as a part of the Attorney General's office. And it's in the focus of that audit work that we would most likely follow up on the use of federal Medicaid dollars by the AG's office.
Okay. Are there any other members? I just don't want to monopolize. Representative Simon.
Thank you. Just a couple quick questions. I guess what I'm at, I don't necessarily see, unless my colleagues see, the need for a formal motion here. But I guess you said that this would come up in the context of that regularly scheduled, either or both regularly scheduled audits. I guess my question is, will it come up, not would it? And can you tell us here today on the record that you will look into these allegations?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative Virgil. Simon. Once we are aware of a possible misuse of federal dollars, we have a responsibility to follow up on that, and we will include an examination of the particular concerns that were raised to us along with a broader view of the Medicaid Fraud Unit within our review of federal compliance work this year.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add to that. When we took testimony from the seven individuals, in addition to Ms. Ferkel and myself being present for all of those, and so hearing not only the words but the body language and the emotion that came with them, we also took the transcripts of each interview and independently gave it to one of our senior managers within the office and asked them to review it independent of any statement from us as to our conclusions on that testimony. We independently gave it to a senior manager, asked them to review it, and to identify any issue in that testimony that would require us to follow up in terms of either an audit or an investigation or any other kind of inquiry. And so we have a number of things. We've mentioned some of them, but we have not mentioned them all, that we intend to follow up on they are a matter of record within our office, and we will. However, I just want to be clear. We do a lot of work that we don't necessarily report, and it may be that given the visibility of this discussion and the involvement of the commission, that we will report the results to you no matter what we find. We conduct a lot of inquiries, investigations, preliminary assessments, audits, where we don't report to you or the public all of what we've done because we don't have findings. We tend to report to you the conclusions that are negative, if you want to call them that, if we have found impropriety or noncompliance. Now, we may have a conclusion that we might report, but we don't always report everything. But I think in the context of what we've considered, we will put out, we can certainly share it with the commission at some point and tell you what the allegation was and exactly what we did and what we found, even if we determined that there was no impropriety.
And Mr. Nobles, that can be done by memo
yes.
We don't have to have a meeting to do that.
Well, it depends, Mr. Chairman, on what we find.
Representative Simon.
One more thing, and thanks for everyone's patience here. I want to emphasize two points. First of all, although I've done, I think, almost all the talking on this issue, I really want to make clear that these are not my allegations. And if there's one thing that I regret respectfully about the wording of the four-page letter, it made it sound like, by referencing me several times when I don't think that was necessary at all, that these were my allegations, and they're not. I have no firsthand knowledge whatsoever about any of these allegations. And I'm not the only one, I'm led to believe, who's been contacted by folks who are either presently with or formerly with the Attorney General's office. And I just really want to make that clear. There have been some insinuations about motives here that I think are really unhealthy and detract from the mission here to really find out what the truth is and serve the public interest. So I hope that we can get away from this person's pushing that or that person's pushing this, because I don't see that that's what this group is about in any of the issues that we cover. It's about serving the public interest in terms of getting the information out there. And then finally, another important note, I would say, I would just hope that throughout this process, that to be fair to the Attorney General, to her staff, to anyone formerly with the office, that people against whom accusations are made be given the opportunity, perhaps under oath if that's something that they want to do, to comment for their own sakes, because these are serious allegations. And I know we always in this room walk a fine line between saying out loud what serious allegations are and risking people jumping to conclusions without giving the folks accused the chance to defend themselves. So I would urge, no matter, as you've done, but to continue to do, and if under oath, if need be, if those folks want to do that, to give everyone who's accused of wrongdoing here the opportunity to explain themselves in writing or in person, because I think that's important as well. The accusations are serious, but precisely because they're so serious, I think those whose names are being mentioned, from the Attorney General and on points lower in the food chain, I think they need to have the opportunity to answer whatever is brought forward.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just respond briefly. And Representative Simon, I named you with some reluctance. It was more in the interest of simply being accurate. And whenever we come to naming individual members, I think I also mentioned Senator Ress's role in that discussion. But it's more in the interest of accuracy than anything else. I certainly know that you are not the only one that expressed concerns about the allegations. And as to putting the Attorney General or former Attorney General or anyone else in the Attorney General's office under oath, I certainly considered that, but I was trying to stay very close to what I had been agreed to and what I'd been charged to do, and that was to conduct a preliminary assessment. And a preliminary assessment is a testing of the credibility of the allegations. It's not an attempt to conduct a full investigation in which you hear both sides of the story. You're basically just testing the credibility of the allegations. I did consider extending an opportunity to the Attorney General, former Attorney General, for an opportunity to explain their side of the story, so to speak, that I had heard in sworn testimony. But it was my conclusion that that would have then been conducting a full investigation. because I would have only taken their testimony under oath. And that, it seems to me, you would have seen as members of the commission and the public as not me conducting a preliminary assessment, but deciding to go forward with a full investigation. So that's why I didn't do it.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Nobles, and Representative Simon, I appreciate, first of all, the willingness on the part of Representative Simon to bring an issue forward. And he's correct. I have had contact with people in the last several days prior to this meeting that have communicated information to me about these circumstances. And Mr. Nobles, you and I had a chance to talk, too. And I guess I want to just maybe reinforce some of the things that you said that I think are important, in that there probably are some things that have gone on that may not be the way that many of us would like to see business conducted, but they may not rise to the level or fall within the scope of what your office is typically charged with doing. And we talked about this at the last meeting in March, of some sensitivity to employing your office in a way that might not be helpful long-term in terms of a precedent. And I guess what I'm interested in is trying to find a way, to Representative Simon's point, is what can we do as a legislature to do the best we can to assure that the public's business is conducted in a way that we can all be proud of and appreciate and have confidence in, and that may, to some degree, not be entirely happening or may not in the past have happened, and we may want to try to look at doing that differently. I think the point that you raise in your letter about the legislature's opportunity to look at the structure of the Attorney General's office, I found that intriguing. It's something that actually I had thought about over the weekend as I talked to some people. And as I looked at my own reluctance to say, let's turn you loose and do a broad-ranging management investigation, I'm really not there. I don't think that is, in my personal opinion, the right way to do this. But it may make sense for us as a legislature to wrestle with the idea, what does the public want from the Attorney General's office? Which of the two models that you indicated, is it more like the governor's office or is it more like the auditor's office? And that may be something that's appropriate for the legislature to wrestle with and one of the committees, the committees that we have, to say, if this is the kind of issue that we're facing right now, if we did something differently, would these issues tend to be diminished over time, or we would lessen the chances of those kinds of issues arising in the future? So I guess I just want to tell you that I appreciate the restraint that you've shown in exercising your authority. Over the time I've served on this committee, I've come to respect your judgment and your willingness to try to do this in a way that is not going to turn your office into a partisan tool, which I think is appropriate. And so I guess to Representative Simon, I just want to say I appreciate the questions you've raised. I think there is something to these questions. That's my judgment from people I've talked to independently. But I agree with Mr. Noble's assessment that asking for a broader investigation on the legislative auditor may not be the right way to do this. And so maybe at this point we need to, as a legislature, go off and think about what we may want to do in the next session, if anything, to pursue this further. But in the meantime, I just want to express my appreciation for the way that you've handled this, and I think you have done a service to the public and to the legislature. And thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have anything further to add, and I know we have some other items on the agenda.
I do want to comment. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm not sure, Senator Hahn, if I agree with you. I'm rereading some of what you wrote in your report to us, Mr. Nobles. And I realize that constitutional offices are directly accountable to the voters. But as you proceed in looking at, for example, the potential of the Medicaid misuse, maybe even fraudulent misuse, is it time to involve the U.S. Attorney's Office? Is that the next step that we can call for or you can call for? Because I think we've exhausted what as you've said, can be done. But can you comment on that, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. We do have a reporting relationship to the federal government through what we refer to as a cognizant agency in the federal government. But we also, if occasion arose, could involve both the U.S. Attorney's Office or an inspector general in any sort of investigation. We could either ask them to do it directly, or we could provide information to them. We do have a certain obligation under what is referred to as the Single Audit Act. It's a federal law which obligates us to do a certain amount of our own audit and investigative work before we turn to them. There have been occasions when I have referred material to the U.S. Attorney and other officials with appropriate jurisdiction. As you know, I'm legally obligated under Minnesota statutes to refer matters to the Minnesota Attorney General for civil recovery, but where that might present, and to an appropriate county attorney for criminal prosecution or consideration of criminal prosecution. But where that is a potential conflict, certainly a U.S. attorney where federal money is involved is a potential avenue. But we're not at that point yet. I think we want to do the work first, see what we find, and then find the appropriate reference for any findings.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, this is a different question. It has to do with the Capital One settlement. Have you been able to discern whether or not this kind of settlement that was below the $750,000 settlement level is a practice that's gone on in the AG's office when it comes to settlements? Was this unique, or have you not looked into whether or not this is based on past practice or something to that nature?
Mr. Nobles. Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, I wouldn't say it's a common practice. It is not unique. It is, frankly, something, again, that I think is a legitimate area of legislative inquiry. This standard that was established, this threshold, was established by you in law. Some of you are aware of the history of this. We actually were involved in another investigation on this matter of potential diversions or negotiation of settlements that might divert money from the Treasury to a nonprofit. Some of you recall we conducted a similar investigation of the Attorney General Mike Hatch in the American Bankers settlement. So it is a matter of legislative concern. It's a matter of legislative regulation. And that's why, frankly, the dollar amount that Representative Simon referenced initially was the major thing that caught my attention. I don't think anybody can look at that $1 less than the legally allowed amount and not think that that looks somewhat suspicious and looks like it calls for some explanation. But the explanation is, as you read it, the legislature set the limit and we didn't go over the limit. So anytime you set a limit, you open up the possibility that somebody's going to go right up to it and not break the law. And that's what occurred. So, but should you keep your eyes on this as a legislature? And yes, absolutely. And you can do that either through the Legislative Auditor's Office or through other oversight means. But this clearly is a matter that the legislature should be concerned with because it is a diversion of money from the general fund. If for no other reason, you have a legitimate call for looking at it. And that is something, given this case and other cases, that we will periodically get reports, require reports from the Attorney General's office about those kinds of settlements.
Any other questions? I do want to point out when we had the charter school, we provided the opportunity for the agency to respond. And members, you have in your packet a letter dated June 17th that I provided to the Attorney General, providing her with the opportunity to address the commission today. And then you have in your packet an envelope that is dated June 30th, acknowledging that she received the letter on June 23rd, and responding to the opportunity to come to the commission today, and also providing to commission members, if they did not have that report to the Attorney General by Thomas Mengler, dated May 27th. So I don't know, Mr. Nobles, if you have copies there, but I believe each of the commission members have that, if they would like to read that. So we did provide the opportunity to the Attorney General. I believe that's a fairness issue, and you have a copy of that letter and a copy of her response. Mr. Nobles.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Did you want me to comment on that?
If you could, because I think you've had some conversations.
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman. Throughout our preliminary assessment, I was in contact with the Attorney General's office. I worked largely through the Solicitor General, Al Gilbert. And through my communication and then formally, as the chairman indicated, through his letter, the Attorney General was invited to be here or to send a representative. And they decided to send the letter instead. I don't really have a lot more to say on that subject, Mr. Chairman. But just to add that, that the inquiry that I conducted was conducted in communication with the Attorney General's office. You saw the documents that they supplied on the Capital One issues. I never received any overt resistance to any of my inquiries. As I indicated, I never made a direct quest to interview the Attorney General or the former Attorney General. So it was their choice to proceed in this way, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nobles and Ms. Furco. We do have a few other items, and I do want to just change the agenda, a small item, because a number of the things that we've talked about here relate to an actual investigation that you are doing, Mr. Nobles, and I think while it's fresh, because these issues of privacy and public data and that, so maybe if we could jump to the DNR investigation.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Some of you may recall that several weeks ago there was a newspaper article that alleged that public money had been used to support a convention of the Minnesota Conservation Officers Association, which is a private organization that has public employees as members, but it is a private organization. It's a union that represents Minnesota's conservation officers. And we felt that those allegations had credibility and clearly fell within our responsibility to investigate. And so we immediately launched an investigation, and we are in the midst of that now. It is a rather complex set of issues. We're gathering a significant amount of documentation, and we are taking sworn statements. One of the complications in this investigation, it's not uncommon, but it is certainly present in this one. Some of the individuals that we are investigating and asking to present themselves to us to be interviewed under oath are also being investigated by an investigator hired by the Department of Natural Resources, and it is, in essence, a personnel investigation that could result in action against these employees. And so they have some liability in terms of their employment, and so there is, in some cases, some reluctance on their part to also subject themselves to an interview by us, since we do not ourselves have the ability to immunize their testimony. In other words, their testimony to us can be used against them, and they do retain a Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, which they can't exercise. And I can only go forward over that objection and over their using their Fifth Amendment privilege and right by going to court, obtaining a court order that would also immunize their testimony. So the investigation could lengthen out a bit, but we are in the process, and I think there are definitely issues involved, and we will proceed as quickly but as thoroughly and judiciously as we can.
Mr. Nobles, you have the authority you need to proceed. You don't need any action from us.
Mr. Chairman, no, I do not need action by the Commission. This does fall under the legislative auditor's authority and responsibility, I might add.
Senator Betzold.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I can understand the sequence, Mr. Nobles, you're going to, it sounds like you're going to let the DNR conduct its review first before you do what comes first?
No, Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzold, we often do these in parallel investigations. The department hires an outside investigator. They work under certain prerogatives and authority that is quite different from ours. We are working as an agent of the legislative branch in legislative oversight and fulfilling our responsibilities, which are directed toward determining whether or not public funds were misused and whether or not they should be obtained through civil recovery. Now, there is the possibility that evidence that we obtain can lead to criminal prosecution, and we have that responsibility to report it. But the department's responsibility is to determine the personnel status of individuals. We have no involvement in that at all. We have no authority and do not address the personnel status of a state employee. Our responsibility is to find the facts, report them to you, and report any possible misuse of public funds to a county attorney and the attorney general. So we are running parallel but totally independent and separate investigations. The investigation being conducted by the department through a private investigator, they do not have subpoena power and they do not take statements under oath. And their testimony is immunized under the Garrity warning.
So, Mr. Senator Chair, Benson. But then your discussion about how you're having a bit of a problem because of the you cannot get offer immunization, and they can assert their Fifth Amendment rights. Would that mean that you can conduct your investigation without talking to the employees themselves, but just kind of gather what you can without having to talk to them? Is that how you are approaching it then?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzold, that's one choice we make. I don't want to leave the impression that all of the people involved and all the employees of DNR are not cooperating and giving us testimony. That's not true. It only relates to certain individuals.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions on the DNR?
Mr. Chairman, just to kind of give you a real quick and brief overview of kind of where we are as we end the fiscal year. Financially, I would say we are in reasonably good shape, and thank you very much to the legislature. We did incur some budget reduction but during the last legislative session, but quite minimal. It was a 1% cut, which is for us a $57,000 cut in our budget that will roll forward in the base. But given our current level of funding, we have stabilized our staff at 61, 62 people. That is obviously not back to where we were some years ago, but we don't anticipate getting there either. And so we really establish our work schedule based on this new reality, so to speak, of that we are an organization of about 60, 61, 62 people. Obviously, you know, people come and go, and there are vacancies from time to time. But to get our work done, we really try to stay as close to that number as we can. We currently have 6 evaluations in process and 2 that we will be getting to as soon as we can. We have 19 audits, financial audits in process, and 2 investigations and others that are pending. One investigation is the one we just discussed. And we are also looking at some issues related to a loan that was offered to a company by Iron Range Resources. We also have a number of other allegations that we are currently reviewing. So we have approximately 27 inquiries ongoing at the present time. And I might just tell you, in case you ever want to sort of check up on your own as to what we're doing, we list all of our ongoing audits On our work in progress under our financial audit division, you can see, and I won't go through that list, but it's on our website if you're ever interested to know what we are currently auditing. Also, that's true of our program evaluations. We list those work in progress. We do not list our ongoing investigations, however. But we are certainly, if you're ever interested to know if we are conducting an investigation, typically we can tell you that is certainly privately. But sometimes they're in a status where we wouldn't necessarily want to talk about them publicly. So I think that pretty well covers the items on the agenda. Oh, there was one other item, Mr. Chairman, and given the late hour, in your packet for your review, and then also we will be sending this out to all legislators today, is a list of what recommendations of ours were implemented by the 2008 legislature. And it's quite a nice list. We think we had a significant impact during the last legislative session, and we appreciate your consideration. We know that many of you individually and as members of various committees of the legislature take up our reports and consider our recommendations. As you know, we do not lobby for implementation, but we certainly will work with you as legislators and members of the commission to help you move legislation forward if you're interested. But I leave this for your review, Mr. Chairman and members.
Any questions from the commission? Any idea when we might need to meet again with the program evaluation or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's going to be some time off before we have more evaluations to release. Just to quickly remind you what those are, oversight of workers' compensation insurance claims, MNSCU occupational programs, personal care assistance program, QComp, ethanol subsidies, and MenCare. None of those are slated for release until the beginning of the next legislative session. And then the two that are pending as soon as staff are available, as you may recall, are E-Verify and Capital Complex Security. So, Mr. Chairman, I would anticipate that we may have some other matters that we want you to consider. Certainly there is the possibility that the DNR investigation will be something that we will want to bring to this commission. And there may be other matters as well.
I've been approached by some members about the school bus evaluation and looking at, since there's been an increase in fuel prices, maybe what the impact of that is. So I think you'll be getting contacted about that. And then I just did want to note again the capital security evaluation that I think that that's an important one. So, any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Meeting adjourned.
There it goes.
Mm-hmm. 8 points.